Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, this will be an interesting conversation, an honest look back at what we've seen through four games. And we'll kind of start with the press conference that's most recent. I think there's a significant piece of information to mine out of that. And get back to the game itself and just give people an idea as to what we thought as to what we've seen through four games and what we might see with the remaining schedule. As always, want to thank Louisiana Hot Sauce, who makes podcasts like these possible. May not always be the most enjoyable time to sit down and record, but doesn't mean that we're not blessed to be able to work with people like that. Three simple ingredients, one great end of product, and would just ask that you continue to support the people that make the Nolcast possible. But why don't we look back at both what was said and perhaps what could have been said in the press conference today, today being Monday, October the 9th.
Yeah, and also including the press conference after the game. You know, I had a lot of people say, what do you want Fisher to say, right? And I thought that was interesting. But, you know, Ingram, I think you look at this, there's a couple things he said that I think were right on, and there's a couple things he said that probably should have been different. So let's start with something they said after the game. Congratulations to Miami. They did a heck of a job, played a heck of a football game, and made the plays when they had to at the end, Fisher said at the start of his postgame press conference. Congratulations to Florida State. Florida State played a hell of a football game, too. Made plays when they had to. Let me ask you, does this bother you?
Yeah. It did. I mean, when I first saw that on Twitter, I had a problem with it. But when you lose to Miami in the fashion that you did, you're probably always going to find fault in what was said, but I thought that was kind of unaware of the room.
Yeah, to me, it's like, look, man, Miami's not a great team. They're not even really that good. They're not even as good as NC State. Don't congratulate yourself after losing a home game to a team that's probably like top 20 good when you made a boatload of mistakes. That when you have more talent in your team, don't congratulate yourself. That's not cool. You need to let the fans know instead that you're mad, that this is not an acceptable level of play. And that you're not cool with this. I understand there's a balance you want to strike with not, you know, hurting the confidence of your players, but you can tell them whatever you want in the locker room. When you're talking to the fans, don't BS them like this. Don't congratulate your team on a hard-fought game. Come on.
Other things that not necessarily so much what the fans could read into, but was directly told to them was the keep cheering comment. I don't want to spend too much time on this, don't want to get bogged down, but I thought that was another thing that was just showed a little bit of a lack of awareness and of the situation.
Like you're taking the fans for granted, maybe? Like, look, I understand he definitely elaborated on this after, and there's a longer, fuller quote, but I was in the room for this. He said, Gene Williams asked him, what message do you have for the fans? And he said, keep cheering. And then there was a good long pause before he starts talking about the other stuff, you know, how much you preach. Look, the answer to this should be this. I'm so glad you asked that. We have the best fans. I'm glad they showed up and were loud. And I'm really sorry we couldn't get the win for them. Our guys did play hard. You could definitely feel that they were seizing on the energy of the crowd. And that's why we needed to keep coming to every game. And we're going to keep fighting and working harder to put a better product on the field and play football up to the standard of Florida State. Because we know certainly we have not done that so far this year. That's a much better answer. Think about that. You like the way that sounds?
Sounded well done, polished. And third in particular quote we wanted to highlight of Jimbo's is a more recent one said this afternoon, and I'll let you read it out as far as what the Charles Kelly's future might look like.
Jimbo was asked about his confidence in Charles Kelly. He said, I have extreme confidence in Charles. Charles is a great football coach, coached a very good game. They made a couple plays at the end, and he's done a really nice job. We'll continue with Charles being our coordinator, and we'll go through this year, and hopefully he can finish the year very strong. I got to tell you, two things here, Ingram. Number one, I didn't have a problem with this answer. I've said before, I don't think he's going to fire anybody midseason. There's nobody on the staff who's capable of calling a defense or has an experience, to my knowledge, calling a defense. That would be probably a real disaster if you were to just can your DC after game number four. But man, I got to tell you, maybe you read into this differently, but I think this quote was pretty telling. And when I heard him say it, I immediately thought, oh, he just slipped, whether intentionally or unintentionally. He let that slip.
I don't think there's any other way to read into that. Absolutely. I mean, that's
You know what word is key?
Well, I know what phrase is key. Yeah. Through this year.
And the year. He said year twice. And I don't think that was an accident. I think he's going to fire Charles Kelly at the end of the year or demote him or in some shape or form Kelly is not going to be, in my opinion, the defensive coordinator at Florida State in 2018. Now, I think Jimbo is trying to maybe send a little message here. Hey, I kind of get it. The defense is not doing its job relative to its talent level, but you're going to have to just kind of ride out these final eight games. And I do think it'll be eight games. I think Florida State is going to play the game against Louisiana Monroe. I think they're going to schedule that as soon as they're out of contention for the ACC and play that after Florida. We got some questions about Charles Kelly's buyout. From what I understand, the remaining amount on his contract is $2.65 million. That is the 18, 19, and 20 seasons. A lot of people thought that was pretty stupid to put a buyout like that on there. But look, what you got to think about is this, and we discussed this before the show, so I'll go through this pretty quickly. In 2014, that whole team had issues. I don't think you can really necessarily pin all that on Kelly. In 2015, the defense played very well. Now, there were some quarterbacks they played that were not as good. In 2016, the defense disappointed, especially early in the year. And they did improve some down the stretch, but then again, they also played some lackluster offenses down the stretch. I don't think, Ingram, this is a four-year mistake. And the timing for Charles Kelly to get this big raise was perfect for him because it came right after his big 2015 year where the defense really did carry that team 10-3 that year, I think. You know, that was really, I think, really good timing. And I understand why Fisher wanted to match that. But I do think, Jimbo, your job is to evaluate your coaches as the head coach. And to not make a change after last year, I think, was a mistake.
I think so. I think some particular plays that we can look at in some situations where I find huge fault in what Kelly did and will be particularly critical of him. I will say this for all the people who don't like Charles Kelly and particularly despise him right now. There's probably not a better person to be in this situation. And I know that doesn't make anybody feel better, but Charles Kelly's a professional. He's a good guy. He will handle this, I think. It's not like I know exactly how Kelly behaves all the time, but I would expect Kelly to probably handle this situation about as well as anybody could. And I don't think he's going to pack it in. But I think that today, look, you can go wrong trying to read through the lines, but I don't think this was an accident. And I think that we have a pretty good idea and to an extent can end the conversation as to if Charles Kelly is to be retained ultimately.
Yeah, at this point, I'd be pretty shocked, you know, but from just people I've talked to and people who I think have a good read on things. You know, what you got to remember, though, is that Jimbo is really big on loyalty and he's really big on pride, you know, thinking he's the smartest guy in the room. I suffer from that problem, too, by the way, sometimes. I know listeners will be shocked about that. And if you're like that, it can be hard to admit mistakes. Firing Kelly after last year, just 1 year after you gave him the big raise, would be admitting a pretty big mistake by Jimbo. And I don't know if that's something that his pride would let him do last year, even if he had made the correct read. And so I guess what I'm saying is Jimbo may have already known last year that he didn't want or that Kelly wasn't the right guy or that he wasn't getting through to the extent he needed to. Or maybe he thought there was some value in continuity because of the team you opened up against in Alabama this year. I think maybe that combination of factors could be. But let's not underestimate the role that his personal pride and not wanting to admit a mistake just a year after lobbying for that big extension could have played and not making a change after last year. I think that could have something to do with this.
Yeah, a prideful individual and a guy who doesn't want to have to acknowledge mistakes and is a guy who's always about the resources and what can be put towards a particular project. And as soon as you fire this guy, you have to take ownership and you have to take ownership that the same people that you want all this money out of, you just made them write a pretty large check to correct your mistake. So I think what you said is absolutely accurate and would be hard to think that did not in some way, shape, or form possibly play into to the retention of Charles Kelly after last year.
The last thing I think here we need to talk about is please stop referencing inches and one play away. This is the talk of losers. And I know right now Florida State is losers because they're losing all these games. That's not cool. And people aren't stupid. Florida State is not one play away. They're not just inches away from playing Florida State football. They may be inches away or plays away from winning one of these games.
But I don't mean to interrupt you. They're inches away from being 0-4. If you want to play the inches
game.
Yes.
Oh, hell yeah.
Homeboy had two hands on the ball in the end zone for Wake Forest. So don't. Let's not have the inches conversation. It's insulting to the fan base. And if you want to have that conversation, it can make for a hell of a lot more awkward one than one that supports your idea as to where this program is.
We've talked about this before, though. I'm not sure who he has over there anymore, who he could listen to. You know, I got to tell you, I think if in previous years, you know, before he passed, I think Monk might have told him, "Hey, Jimbo, that sounds really stupid. Don't say that. Don't say that repeatedly. That's something you're saying too often, and people are going to get annoyed with it, and it's just really not true." But now I don't know who he trusts over there, who he can really go to for advice, who's around that, and who has the ability to speak up and tell him.
Who knows? Hard to say. He needs a good consigliere over there, good wartime consigliere this time, for a little bit of a Godfather or Mafia reference, but needs somebody that he's able to talk to, and maybe he has that, and you and I just aren't aware of it. It's not.
If he does, he's not listening to him.
Yeah, it doesn't appear to be, but who knows? That's kind of palace intrigue and stuff that is hard to be sure as to exactly what's going on.
That's fair.
Let's do talk about the defense, and we'll work our way through what happened on Saturday and what we've seen through the first quarter of the year. Part of my frustrations, Bud, is that this defense has some of the elements that you and I sat here a couple months ago and said if it's going to be really good, it needs to have a second defensive tackle who's able to really play at an impactful level and make somebody game plan for him.
Check.
In the two biggest games of the year, DeMarcus Christmas has been that and more. Seriously. That Matthew Thomas can come back in and play at the level that we've thought, at least at times, he hadn't been perfect this year, but show that athleticism and play at the level that he had the potential to. And that, for the most part, has happened. Josh Sweat has, your defensive line in general, has played at a really high, consistent level. And you sure are squandering a lot of special pieces on that side of the ball.
We're going to keep holding this defense to the incredibly high standard that the level of talent dictates it should play at. This is a healthy defense. It's a loaded defense. There are a lot of future first and second rounders on this defense. And it's a defense that makes way too many mental mistakes. It's a defense that is not consistently enough put in position to best utilize their talent. I can't tell you how many times the guys are playing with the incorrect leverage. On this play, they're supposed to have outside leverage because they have safety help to the inside. Instead, where does he play? Inside leverage. How about here? Oh, he needs to have outside or inside leverage. What's he doing? Oh, he's letting the guy cut in front of him for the slant because he has poor technique. Look, man, Charles Kelly did a really good job when he was a linebacker's coach and special teams coach. Through 4 years now, I'm not convinced he's a good defensive backs coach. And he really doesn't get this defense to play together. That's why he's got to go. Just those two things. I mean, just basically the two central functions of his job are just not being done, you know, to the high enough standard. Clearly, their message is not getting through, and he's a hard worker. But that doesn't mean results, and this is a results-based business. This defense is just loaded, and it played pretty well for a lot of the game. And yes, I think you can actually put more of the blame in this game on the offense. However, I'm not going to do that because the offense has a lot of things going against it right now with injuries and experience, true freshman quarterback. This defense is damn near 100% healthy and should be dominating. And they're just not doing it enough to allow 6 yards, 70, or 6 plays, 75-yard touchdown, 9 plays, 75 yards, touchdown on the final 2 drives of the game. That's embarrassing. That's a fireable offense, which is why I think it'll happen. Especially, don't underestimate this. That's Jimbo Fisher's offense that just led a game-winning drive,
mm-hmm.
and then gets shown up by the defense.
Not the first time that's happened.
Right. 7 times in 17 games, conservatively. Watch Jimbo when they score. What does he do? He kind of shakes his head and looks up at the sky. I mean, I'm telling you, man, he's not happy with a lot of coaches on his staff just from the interactions he has. There's the play after Gavin gets hurt. Go back and watch what he looks and what he does to Dossie. I had a friend tell me, he said, "I've had that look twice in my life, and I was fired within a week both times."
That was a funny comment from your friend.
Yeah, I said, I can't disagree. A lot of people are going to focus on the final play, and I think you and I both agree on this. The final play is actually not that bad, right? Jimbo said they've been playing pretty good press man for the day. I think that's in part true. All right, so what are they in? They're in cover one robber, which means you got a deep safety, and you have a kind of a rover in the middle of the field who can help to rob some seam routes, because Miami was doing a pretty good job of hitting some of the over-the-middle routes. That's oftentimes where people look to attack this defense. They don't typically throw the ball very well outside the hashes on this defense, and it just so happened that they hit one on McFadden, who other than that had had a really good day. Jimbo's not lying when he says that.
Playing defense, yes.
Yes. Oh, God, yeah. The not catching the punts was pretty ridiculous over and over again. But they're going to keep him back there because he just needs to learn to do it, I guess, despite the fact he'll be in the NFL next year. You know, at some point, maybe switch a guy out there, Jimbo. Just not good enough. Not disguising blitzes, I think, is a major concern I have here, and it's something we've seen over and over again. The timing of the blitzes. This defense repeatedly, under Charles Kelly, shows their blitz way too early. Do you agree with me on that? I don't know. Maybe that's just personal pet peeve, but it just seems like constantly, man.
Some of it's on the player. Some of it's on the vast majority of it's on the scheme. Sometimes I think we can be a little bit better with how we time those things, and to an extent, that may be on the player. But this, I don't want to. A podcast isn't a great place to go into granular detail about particular plays, and you guys have done this for forever and break down individual plays. It's a superior product than what you're going to find out there for pretty much any team that you guys devote that much to every game. It's the second to last drive that is maddening to me, and it involves a disguised blitz where McFadden shows it way too early, or the scheme shows it way too early, or how he's coached shows it way too early. You can decide whatever guilty party there is. But he looks back, and he appears to still get the call to go. So he goes for a blitz. He doesn't really... He kind of quits on the play to an extent because it was red. So what you end up doing is you end up having a blown coverage with your linebacker there who's maybe not playing the same position that he always does. I think they've probably practiced that once or twice, so I'm not going to fully put that on just the player or just the coach, but you yourself created that situation. You created a misidentification of what was required out of those players, and it was because you did the same blitz a couple series previous where you did cancel it. You called it off and McFadden dropped back. And so I think that's what Pugh sees. And you end up giving up, I don't know, a 56-yard play or whatever down your own sideline. That, to me, is the play of the game. And that, to me, was almost all a byproduct of all the things that we complain about, whether it's disguised blitzes, whether it's potentially asking kids things to do that they're not completely well-versed on. And it's just creating a lack of true conception as to what everybody's being asked to do, and you end up blowing what is maybe the most important coverage of the day.
That was huge. Look, I understand Pugh has actually played there a lot in practice. I've talked to some sources, and they've said, look, he's repped that a lot. Still maybe not the guy you want covering a pretty athletic tight end there.
But he didn't get out there. He didn't somewhere
right.
from.
It wasn't
from
like he was beat
McFadden
physically.
Being told to still go. There was a miscommunication on the sideline,
which to me comes down to what
creating that situation in the first place. I mean,
coaching.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Coaching. It's
are you saying like the defense lacked coordination in this play?
Yes. Thank you, sir. Perhaps it wasn't all that well coordinated. And when I saw that situation play out, that I closed the book. That's all I need to see. We don't need to have conversation anymore. You created a situation where you failed your players and you blew what is maybe the most situationally important in the game.
And look, you know, maybe I'm not saying put somebody else on Berrios because I actually think Myers had some decent coverage throughout the day. And Berrios is really good and really savvy. And he's kind of one of those guys like just almost too old for college football, you know. But I think they could have mixed up their looks a little bit with some of the coverages they played. Having Myers play Berrios that much in press man in the slot gives Berrios a two-way go, and that's a really difficult job to ask Myers to do. So I'm not really convinced that you're putting Myers there in the best position to succeed. And just this is what we're saying too often, man. Like, if the players are getting beat physically, get better players. If they're not, get better coaches. What's happening? They're getting beat on a lot of mental mistakes and technique errors for the most part. There's not a whole lot of times when they got beat physically. I'll actually tell you that the throw that Rozier made to whatever the kid's name was, the kid that had like no catches on the year, scored a winning touchdown, is actually like a pretty bad throw. And I thought the kid made just an incredible adjustment. I mean, it's really pretty far away from McFadden. McFadden does not play that poorly, in my opinion. For him to catch that and be able to turn and do that was a remarkable play. And that's sort of a tip of your cap, but I'm not tipping my cap when Miami hits the play to the tight end because nobody covered him because the defense seems to be confused. or because you don't mix up your looks and your blitzes enough to where you run that cowboy blitz a lot and don't. Did you see any, like, much, if any, pressure up the middle last week? I didn't see much of it, man. Like, they don't do a great job of opening up holes to blitz through A gap, B gap, C gap. Mm-hmm. It's almost all edge pressure. And I feel like at a certain point, maybe after you've seen it for a whole damn game, that becomes predictable. I do understand that against a zone read team, you run that cat blitz, or, you know, cat, cowboy, whatever you want to call it, the corner blitz.
Short side blitz to the corner.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that is to combat some of the RPO read, and that's a smart strategy. But you can do a little too much, and if they see it coming, you got to be able to check out of it. And their combination of poor technique and lack of disguise is fatal. If you're going to not disguise your defense well enough, which they do a lot of times, you got to play really good technique. Or change it up and confuse somebody for once. They don't do that a whole lot. You don't see a whole lot of guys, and I understand turnovers have a large luck component. And that's true. But you don't see guys throw balls right to our defenders too often, right? Opposing quarterbacks don't seem to look confused very much. And that's an issue of defensive coordination. That's why there's got to be a change. By the way, I don't know about you, definitely a lot of rumors out there about maybe some defensive linemen or defensive line coaches not being real happy with some of the secondary and players in the back seven or their coaches. They got reason to be mad. Defensive line played its butt off, all right, almost the whole game. Did a great job against Mark Walton and Miami's run game for almost the whole game. And it's got to be frustrating to look back and see a ball completed when you've done a pretty good job rushing the passer. Just saying. You want to talk offense, or you got more defense?
That's all I have to say. That's all I got to say about the defense. We can close that book. Offense, bud. So a little bit of a challenge here to not be too jaded by the beginning or not too elated by the end. So interested in trying to see what we take away from this. Before we do jump into that, I know you got a chance to be in Tallahassee this weekend and stop by a couple of the locations that are able to make a podcast like this possible. Why don't you just give a first-person review of what you were able to consume?
Yeah, man, Township was really good. Got over there, had a couple brews. Now, they don't do the steins actually on game day, which I think is a smart thing here due to the – especially not on Miami game day, because you got some of those folks who are you know, maybe on work release or something. I think there's probably a safety issue there, and so I applaud them. But they have such a great beer selection, man. And a lot of people are having the cheesy tots and some awesome game day food there. Great atmosphere. You know, look, it was kind of hot during the middle of the day. And they got these really nice big fans in there that aren't loud, but they do move some air. Keeps it really nice. They had the roll-down windows open. Great patio atmosphere as well. It's just, Matt and those guys got a really good thing going over there. It feels like it's all connected. They have good coordination, right? Whoever's the restaurant coordinator there is better than Florida State's defensive coordinator because they, you know, you can tell like they work together as a team with Township, Madison Social, and Centrale. And it's a great trio of concepts. And I had some of my friends go to Soto, and they said that the line was long but actually manageable and moved through there pretty quick, and that the stuff was really good. So.
Yeah. I know producer Judson got a chance to go to Soto and sent some positive responses as to his time there as well. So just keep that in mind.
It seems like For the Table Restaurant Group plays all four quarters with their four concepts, unlike Florida State this year, which seems to not be able to put together four quarters on offense or defense. So I guess
saying there's some inconsistency with aspects of this program.
We call that a transition. Yeah. Ingram, they scored 3 points in the first half.
They did. They scored 3 points in the first half in a game that would have been hard for them to dominate aspects of it, for them to dominate in a more thorough fashion.
They outgained Miami 124-24 in the first quarter. You can make a really good argument, and I will, that they lost this game not in the second half, but in the first half. Do you recall the Oregon game, by the way?
Yeah, I have that stored somewhere in a dramatic space of my mind.
So my thought was this, right? At the half of the Oregon game, I was like, all right, man, they have really done a great job of scheming some stuff open. They've moved the ball. They've really confused Marcus Mariota. And they just haven't really capitalized on these opportunities. And so this thing can go one of two ways. Do you think that domination will continue into the second half? Or do you think perhaps maybe the adjustments to be made are not by that of FSU, but by the opponent because FSU had a great plan coming out? Well, in the Oregon game, the latter was the case, right? Those dropped interceptions didn't get thrown to defenders in the second half. They didn't have a chance to drop them. Mariota was no longer confused. And FSU couldn't move the ball quite as well, and they also had some turnovers. They lost that Oregon game in large part in the first half because if they had cashed in their opportunities, they'd have been playing with a large lead, and Oregon has to play a little bit differently and chuck the ball around a lot more as opposed to still a very close game. 3 points in the first half is terrible. It's not the first time we've seen this, though, from Jimbo Fisher. I think schematically his offense makes a lot of sense, but his game management is just really poor. It's like he thinks he's playing in like 1998 NFL where you know, 10 to 3 is a likely possible score. It's not. College football, even the best defenses are going to give up some points. Even Alabama gives up points. Even Clemson gives up some points. That's why you don't see totals for their games posted at like 30, right? The total, the over-under for these games right. are still almost always in the 50s, occasionally the high 40s. You've got to figure that you need to score 28 or 30 points to win a college football game against a competent team. Punting the ball inside of the 40 twice, and he had some nonsense explanation for it today again, which, whatever. The hubris that it takes to think your gut is better than like a lot of proven analytics is pretty audacious. But twice, gave it away. And it's like he didn't even think about playing for two downs there. Okay, his answer today in the press conference indicated that he thought the other alternative that was being asked about was kicking a field goal as opposed to managing the situation and maybe saying, okay, throw one short of the sticks. And guess what? I've got an article coming about this on Tomahawk Nation, and my tentative title for this right now, if you're interested, Jimbo Fisher pairs snail's pace with college football's worst fourth down approach. When you play as slow as FSU does on offense, and this is not specific play calling, this is just approach I'm talking about. When you take forever to get a play called because your head's in the play sheet and you're trying to figure out, you know, use your offensive genius to pick out the most perfect play, and you get it in with like 10 seconds left and they have no time once they get up there, that means you're not going to get a whole lot of possessions. You know who does that? Army, Navy, Air Force. Triple option service academies. They play super slow. They want to slow down the game. Teams with talent disadvantages want to do this, which means you have to value each possession that much more. So for Fisher to take and show that he doesn't understand the need to value possessions and pair that with playing so slowly. They're 121st in the nation in pace, and that's not new. They were 120th a couple years ago. They have never, that I can figure out, at least back far as I can see under Jimbo, been in the upper half of the nation in adjusted pace measure. You cannot pair the two. Those triple option teams who play super slow, they go for it all the time. I'd be okay with Jimbo's punting strategy if he played at a pace that his hair was on fire. Because you know what? Florida State would get a boatload of possessions. And that talent advantage they have would show out. Mm-hmm. But pairing these two approaches together, as he consistently does, results in the offense always scoring fewer points than you think it should score. Does that sound familiar? Because to me, it does a lot.
It does. I also think there's some other very kind of deleterious impacts of this, Bud. It's that your head coach gets so lost in his playbook, so looking for the perfect play that he misses other things that are going around him. That's certainly been a concern previously in this program. It also makes you think that maybe you spend so much time looking for the perfect play, or that you become so reliant upon your play that you don't trust people who are otherwise not able to execute that perfect play. So every play becomes so critical that you don't get in younger skill position players. There's just what you said, which is great, and I look forward to your article, and some of the stats that you've already pulled together for that are really, really impressive. But I also think there's other kind of ancillary impact of this, and there's a lot of things that is limiting throughout the program, I think.
Like the message it sends to your team, it says, I don't trust you?
I think the message it sends to your team, I think the development of younger players, I think maybe the ability to get more people on the roster thinking that they're impacting or contributing in some way. I think this has a lot of things that has some negative side effects.
I totally agree. I absolutely. Now, I also didn't really like the plan that he had early on in this game. I like the runs.
Let me pause you 1 second, bud.
Yes.
There's also another very negative impact of this. And it's that other people know that you're doing that. So it limits your ability on third down to even be successful. If they know that you're going to throw the ball on third and seven for 8 or 9 yards and that there is no concept as to a second play, then you just made yourself that much easier to defend and that much more of a challenging to actually pick up those third and seven, third and eights, and you just lead right into a situation where you haven't picked up anything. You're looking at a fourth down that's fourth and eight or something like that, and you end up punting inside the 40, and you end up wasting a first half that you were far, far and away the better team.
Let's talk about how many times you've gone for fourth down in the last 7 seasons coached. Urban Meyer has gone 154 times. Dabo Swinney has gone for it 140 times. Nick Saban has gone for it 114 times. Do you want to guess how many times Jimbo Fisher has gone for fourth down in the last 7 seasons?
I believe you mentioned this to me previously, so it wouldn't be completely... I'll let that be a rhetorical guess to the listening audience.
50! Nick Saban has gone for it twice as often. He's a defensive coach. Dabo Swinney, almost 3 times as often. Urban Meyer, actually 3 times as often. If you... this is amazing. They are dead last in going for fourth down attempts over the last 7 seasons by a mile. Did you know that 119 out of 121 FBS teams in that span have gone for it at least 91 times? So everybody but two has gone for at least 91 times.
Wow.
LSU under Les Miles, who was way conservative, went for it 74 times. Jimbo Fisher is down there as the outlier of outliers at 50 attempts. This is, if you don't think defenses know that Jimbo is way too conservative and a bad manager of games, yeah, they do. 50 times. That's horrible. That's not using all the downs you're allotted. That's showing that you don't either don't understand or don't care about the value of possession relative to the value of field position. That you are overvaluing the value of field position and undervaluing the value of possession. Trading possession of the ball for 20 yards or 25 yards is ridiculous. That's not a good trade-off, and it's one of the reasons Jimbo loses these games. Do you think he knows how far down they are in this, that they are dead last by like that much?
I think that would come to a surprise. I think that would come very much as a surprise to him.
Okay, Ingram, these teams that run the similar pace to them, you want to guess how many times Army's gone for it in that span? A team that doesn't get many possessions, just like FSU doesn't get many possessions? 227. Air Force, 204. Navy, 190. Georgia Tech, 184. Those teams get it, man. If you're only going to have the ball 12 times, you need to maximize every damn possession. Florida State only gets the ball 12 or 13 times in a game and acts like possession is not a big deal. It's just like, oh, we'll just throw these couple away. I'm sure we'll score a touchdown on all the other ones. Get out of here. That's nonsense. I'm going to call that a Jim botch, right? When Jimbo botches game management, that to me, I write that down on my notes actually as a Jim botch. I didn't like how many times they had straight dropbacks early in the game for Blackman on the second and third longs.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see like a play action or a rollout or maybe a little RPO or some running the quarterback, something there that kind of pairs in with what we're talking about. The first three passing downs in this game down in Miami territory, second and seven, third and seven, and third and seven, just straight dropbacks against a very good, very aggressive Miami front. Let's move the pocket. Let's do something. Later in the game, I'll give Jimbo Fisher credit. I thought he did that better. And his quarterback was seeing ghosts early in this game. You could tell. He was double clutching. There were guys open. I could see it in the booth. When you go back and watch on the replay, and I confirmed some sources as well, there were definitely guys open. You can't see it on the TV copy. later in the game, I'll give Jimbo a lot of credit. He seemed to calm Blackman down, whatever he needed to do, and he found guys open, and he hit them. And a lot of those plays, actually, if you watch, are the exact same ones that he double-pumped and showed hesitation on early in the game. So Jimbo is a really good coach at some things, man. That's what I'm talking about. Like, there's no reason for him to limit himself with all these dumb punts or poorly advised field goals. Because when his offense does, when they actually keep the ball, he's pretty damn good. Even considering all these injuries and the fact you got a true freshman quarterback who's only been on campus for about 3 months. That's why giving away the ball is so frustrating.
Yeah, when you combine those two P's, when you combine the pace that we play at and the what we do when we decide to punt, that is a horrible, horrible combination. And it's very, very limiting to the roster that you spend so much time putting together every February. And it's just cheating yourself of all the pieces that you go out and work so hard to secure their commitment.
I love your part about player development, by the way. I hadn't even thought about that. And I always think, man, FSU never blows any teams out because they don't run enough plays and they don't get backups into the game. But that contributes to their inexperience because they don't get backups into the game because they only run like 65 plays. Well,
they also don't get backups into the game, right, because I don't think they have confidence in that they're going to make the right decision because this isn't super complicated, all the things, but it is more complicated than most. And when you're so reliant upon the play and not the player, maybe you don't get that true freshman in for three or four catches or three or four reps in the first two games of the year and start to work him into your offense because you're so reliant upon every play and so much more reliant upon the play than the player.
You know what play made me smile?
The zone read.
There's a bat because, Florida State hasn't managed to screw up James Blackman's ability to run the zone read yet because he hasn't been on campus long enough like they have seemingly every other quarterback they've had under Jimbo. But, and I'm serious about that. Like, guys get worse at the zone read as the longer they're in FSU system, period. But I love that bump pass to Keith Gavin. It only went for like 4 or 5 yards. You know what I'm talking about? The one I bring in motion. That's what you need to see more of. It's plays that don't have to be all that complicated. You don't have to win a game of chess if you have better checkers. Just get your better players the ball any way you can. Is Gavin real football smart? No. He messes up a lot of routes. I don't think he's all that well coached. My feelings on the receiver coaching on this team are pretty well known. But that's what better college offenses do. They get the ball to their playmakers any way they can. So Gavin can't run routes really well. Okay, guess what? He can definitely come in motion and take a pitch and use that big, fast body and get some yards. I mean, now he's got a busted up ankle, so we'll see how long that takes. But you see my point. Do that more, okay? Nobody cares how you win as long as you win. Nobody's going to say, well, I'm going to give Jimbo an extra win in the record book because his scheme was so drastically, schematically superior to that of the other. Give me a break. How many different plays do you think Miami ran? Not that many. They ran that RPO like 30 times. You don't have to out-scheme everybody all the time. Let's talk some personnel real quick. We already talked about Blackman got better. I think that was really encouraging. The receivers are really banged up, dude. I mean, we're going to see just how well he can get some of these younger guys to play. I like the offensive line's play for the most part. And Dickerson is clearly limited, and you mm-hmm. saw that sometimes. Yeah. He's usually really good.
He doesn't have anything on one of those ankles. It's I know we're critical of kids, but you also have to recognize, like some of your wide receivers are right now, that people are giving you everything they can. They're just significantly limited.
Yeah, exactly. This would be a great time, by the way, for Nooney Murray to step up. Really, really good time, I think, if that could happen, because they're going to need him, because they're not going to have Gavin for a couple weeks, I think. So – yeah, maybe you get him back by Clemson.
Self-inflicted wound, but I hate it for the kid. But absolutely, I mean, all the complaints that we have about what's going on there, the play against Michigan was the worst thing to happen to that kid. He just has no business in taking that play out of the end zone. And his whole style to kick off, he'd really be a better punt returner than he would be a kick returner because he wants to like wait and see a lane and then explode into it, which is just not what you can really do as a kick returner. If you're going to take a kick 4 yards out of the end zone, you can't try to set something up, man. You got to get north and south and hope there's a seam there and you get to break one. It's just fundamentally wrong, and he got himself in a bad situation, and I hated to see it for him.
Yeah, man, that sucks. I thought running backs played really well. Cam Akers showed some maturity. Look, for all the problems that Jay Graham's special teams have, and he's the special teams coordinator, I got to give the guy credit. He's had incredible talents at him under running back, sure. But he's also done a good job getting them to play to their talent level pretty early in their careers.
Absolutely.
That's all you can ask. Recruit studs, get them ready.
Accelerate the level of play. Yeah, I agree with you there. He's done a good job. And Akers, man, he's so – you get the feel. He's so close to taking, you know, one of those 26-yarders and turn it into a 79-yard house call. But
he's just got to make somebody miss downfield.
Yeah.
That's what's missing. Because, like, okay, he's not trying to make guys miss in the backfield anymore. He's hitting the holes much better. His vision looked really good. Just when you get downfield, man, make somebody miss.
Damn near snapped one of the Miami linebackers' ankles right off his body on one of those plays. I mean, that's one of the – it's one of the more dramatic shakes in that angle that I've seen a running back do to a kid. So he's got a little shake to him, too. And damn, is that kid not just strong as hell to be a true freshman. So a lot of things to be real excited about. And again, another game where you got to tip your cap to Jacquez Patrick. Ran real hard, particularly in the first quarter, was a significant player for you. And nice effort for a second week in a row from number 9.
Two more things here. Number one, did you see FSU stole Wake Forest screen?
I did see that, and I loved it.
Twice. That was cool. If that's a rule, then you're allowed to do that. That's great. Very smart. I like to see that. They sprung somebody on that one time. Number two, man, it's good Tim Brewster can recruit because like he just cannot get Maven Saunders to block. They pulled Maven Saunders. I'm not sure he came back into the game much, if at all, after that. And they were actually having to use Vickers as that sort of like wing tight end.
Right.
You can tell from how much they call that formation instead of just regular I formation that they wanted to use two tight end looks against Miami. And Saunders just comes out there, Hedge is not in the game, and just totally blows the block on the first play he's really in there. And thus they're having to line up Vickers as a wing. I thought he did a pretty decent job, actually. That's two like nice bounce-back games for Vickers after I didn't think he played very well against NC State. So that's encouraging. But, man, with all these receivers out and with Saunders showing he can't block, you're going to have more multi-back sets. And you're probably going to need to threaten the defense more with the quarterback run game. They didn't do that enough. They had one where Blackman pulled it. I think you need to see three or four of those. I really do, just to make the defense respect that more because they're charging so hard off the edge at these run plays. And now they're going to be even more amped up on the run because they know Florida State's not going to have Gavin and Tate's, you know, banged up, and Murray's been a no-show this year.
And Campbell's injured as well.
And Campbell's got the core hernia or whatever. All right, last thing, recruiting, let's end on a positive note. I think that they're going to have to move on to a lot of Plan B kids as this cycle goes on, most likely. However, one kid who's a Plan A kid is Houston Griffith. I'm a big fan, dude. Athletic, like not a freak athletically, but he's got good size and good athleticism for his size, and he's a smart football player. You know, he's an NFL legacy. He understands what the heck he's doing. He's an IMG kid. I think he's a guy, because of his smarts, can play early. And that could be a really nice pickup for them, assuming he sticks. I think he will. Ohio State liked him. Nebraska wanted him. So some nice names you beat out there. Good job, Florida State, to go down to IMG and get him. And I think that also can help the culture of your team when you have guys who are NFL legacies because they've grown up around locker rooms. You know, they understand what a winning culture or professional culture should be like.
All right, man. That's another at times less than comfortable podcast, less than enjoyable, but we'll see where we go from here. We'll have a Duke preview for you out later on, and we'll probably turn more of our attention to recruiting, try to figure out what's a realistic expectation and what a season like this, how may it impact this class and how much of it potentially bleeds into 2019.
This concludes this episode of the Nolecast. Make sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Write us at thenolecast@gmail.com or tweet us at Nolecast. So that was pretty bleak. The walls are kind of closing in. Everything's starting to become sad and empty and hollow. But you know what? There is hope on the other side of pain and sorrow. And that is death. So with that, I leave you until Thursday or Friday morning, whenever this is out, for the Duke preview, and then maybe I'll be in a better mood. So today's date is August 10th, 2017, for Ingram Smith and Bud Elliott. This is your producer, Judson Wright, signing out.